Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone, your host today on 1600 AM WHAM in Ann Arbor. And we're glad to be your host on Veterans Radio. We got a great show today. We're going to talk about one of Detroit's own, Vincent Padden, who became the Chief Master Sergeant of the United States Coast Guard after a long career. And we're also going to talk to the president and CEO of U.S. Vets, which is celebrating its 25th year of service, helping veterans. So I think you'll find both of these very interesting discussions. Before we get to that, we're coming in off of the midterm elections here in the United States. So after Tuesday's midterm contests, the number of female veterans and younger veterans in Congress will continue to rise, but the overall number of veterans in Congress seems to be on a steady decline. It's being reported that the 115th session of Congress, which will start at the beginning of the year, will have roughly 102 veterans in it, notwithstanding there were 173 veterans running for Congress in these midterm elections. So we saw an uptick in the number of non-incumbent veterans who got major party nominations, and certainly a number of women veterans entered the political fray. Let's hope that this new crowd of congressional veterans can focus on and really help solve issues that veterans face after they transition out of military service. And one more thing I'd like to bring to your attention. The VA recognizes that legal services are an important component for veterans to make sure that their life stays on track, often facing stressful situations such as eviction, foreclosure, child support, or driver license revocations. So VA, representatives of the Department of Labor, Justice, Defense, Homeland Security, and the Navy, and others, signed a joint statement aimed at improving access to free legal services for veterans in need in those areas. Currently, VA hosts over 170 free legal clinics in its VA medical centers, community-based outreach clinics, and VA vet centers across the country. It's partnering with local bar associations and law school clinics to provide these kinds of free legal services. We wanted to bring this to your attention because we often run into folks who have those kind of problems with no place to turn. So next time you're at your VA medical center or CBAC, ask the social workers, hey, is there a free clinic here? Legal clinic that I might be able to get some questions answered to on some of what to you will be important issues like employment issues or housing or driver's license, and maybe there'll be a resource there locally that you didn't know about that you can utilize and that the VA is bringing right to you in the community. So I thought we'd pass that along to you so that you could ask next time that you're in. We'll be right back with the start of our program talking to Vince Padden right after this message from our sponsor.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard, retired Vincent W. Padden III. Vince, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Why, Jim, thank you so much for having me, and hello to everybody.
Well, this is a great honor, certainly to talk to somebody who spent 30 years in service, rose to the ranks to retire out as the Master Chief Petty Officer of the United States Coast Guard. And we don't get a chance to talk to a lot of Coasties, so we're going to tell our listening audience a little bit about today's Coast Guard. But let's start with your background, Master Chief. Where'd you grow up, and how did you end up in the Coast Guard?
Well, I'll try to shorten that story because it's pretty long. But I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, and Grew up there, went to school there, graduated from Cass Technical High School, 1972, and immediately went into the Coast Guard within just 3 days after graduation. So that kind of back up a little bit about in my growing up is and how I ended up in the Coast Guard was my oldest brother, who's 10 years older, I'm sorry, 8 years older than I am, when he graduated from high school, I was 10 years old at the time, and he went into the Navy. He wrote home, and he sent me pictures and told me how great the Navy was and how much he was having a good time, and I fell in love with wanting to go into the Navy. So from age 10 up till age 17, that's all I thought about, that's all I talked about. My bedroom was plastered with Go Navy, Fly Navy, whatever. So everybody, all my friends knew I was going into the Navy. So anyway, because of that, my parents told me on my 17th birthday that for a birthday present that I would be allowed to go into the Navy's delayed enlistment program. The delayed enlistment program is you can sign up when you're a senior in high school as long as you're at least 17 years of age. And then when you graduate from high school, you can go right into the military. So I was very excited. My birthday actually fell on a Sunday, November 21st, to be exact, November 21st, 1971. And I couldn't wait for that Monday morning to run down to the Navy office and sign up. So when I got out of school, I went down to the Federal Building in downtown Detroit, walked into the hallway there where all the recruiters were located, and at the very end of the hallway, I saw a gentleman in a Navy uniform sitting at his desk on the telephone and in a Navy uniform. So that's the plan. I beelined right for the office. So as I walked in, he says, "Have a seat. I'll be right with you." And just as I got ready to sit down, I looked at the pictures on the wall, and then I realized I walked into the wrong recruiting office. Back then, the Coast Guard uniform, this is a true story. Back then, the Coast Guard uniform was the same as the Navy uniform, and I really didn't pay attention to the door. So so I was embarrassed, and too embarrassed to just walk out thinking, you know, let him think I made a mistake. So I decided to hang around, wait till he got the phone, pretend that I was interested, and then go find a Navy recruit. Well, while he's on the phone talking, I'm walking around the office, and I'm looking, and I see all these fascinating pictures of the Coast Guard. Just the Coast Guard in action and all kinds of this, a Coast Guard icebreaker in the South Pole, two ships battling a fire. I mean, this is all exciting. And then and then hanging on the wall was a unit commendation award, which unit commendation awards are given to an entire unit when an entire unit does something superb. So this unit award that I read, which belonged to one of the recruiters in the office, read like a novel, and it was about a rescue that the Coast Guard was heavily involved in. In fact, it's a rescue that goes down in history as the greatest rescue the Coast Guard has ever been involved in, the 1952 rescue, which they made a movie out of called The Finest Hours. So I read this citation, got very excited, and I said, "Oh yeah, I'm going to the Coast Guard." So that's how I ended up in the Coast Guard.
That is an incredible story, and who would have thought 30 years later that you would have served that whole period, three decades, with the United States Coast Guard because of that just accidental meeting at the recruiter's office.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And of course, you know, later I told my brother, and my brother was very excited for me. Actually, and he said, "You know, several years I've been in the Navy now, and I found out about the Coast Guard, and I kind of thought I should have gone in the Coast Guard too." He was very proud of me. Yeah, and I had, you know, everything worked out in the Coast Guard for me. It's a great service, which has a multiple levels of responsibility, from being a military service as well as a humanitarian a service that does things, you know, search and rescue, law enforcement, protecting the environment and our nation's waterways, all kinds of things of what the missions of the Coast Guard is all about. And it's small, smaller than the New York Police Department, about 42,000 Coast Guard members spread out, not just around the country, but around the world as well. And I had a fascinating with all the different.
Well, one of the things I do want to talk about is sort of today's current Coast Guard and all of those kind of responsibilities protecting us, certainly along the United States continental and United States coastline, but it also ends up having an overseas assignment and detailed off to the Department of Defense at times of conflict and war. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the Coast Guard does here on the home front, and then tell us a little bit about what the Coast Guard does overseas.
Well, it's fun. The best way to describe the U.S. Coast Guard is kind of like its name implies, guarding the coast. As we use this term, Homeland Security, which, of course, you have a department and so forth, Homeland Security was always a mission of the Coast Guard since its creation in 1790, which when it was then called the Revenue Cutter Service, and it was founded by our Secretary of Treasury at the time, Alexander Hamilton. And the primary mission of the Coast Guard was primarily, particularly at that time, was the assurance that ships that sailed to sea, that first and foremost, that they were safe. We protected them from pirates, and we also ensured that the ships that came in and left the U.S., that they paid their taxes, which is why this was all started under the Treasury Department. And as the years went on, the Coast Guard really became much more of a formidable military service, supporting the U.S. Navy in armed conflict. And since 1790, the Coast Guard has participated in every major war since its inception. And today, even today, we have U.S. Coast Guardsmen stationed over in the Persian Gulf and have been there since the Iraq War, primarily roles and responsibilities is assurance of protecting the embargo that was in place as a result of the Iraq-Afghanistan War and the assurance of making sure that those vessels that transit in and out of that particular region are protected and that are safe. So we have seen, particularly in the last 20 years or so, the Coast Guard's role and mission very much expanded far beyond what traditionally most people think of the Coast Guard, primarily, which is search and rescue.
And certainly the Coast Guard has a wide variety of tools at its disposal. We would all think about ships and boats, but our listeners might be surprised to hear it has airplanes as well, and in today's times, it actually uses drones as part of its package of equipment to advance its mission. So as you worked your way up through the enlisted ranks in the United States Coast Guard, Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard, Vincent W. Padden III, now retired, tell us a little bit about that whole suite of equipment that's, some might say toys, but we know they're deadly, so they're not, that whole suite of equipment that the Coast Guard has at its disposal.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit by virtue of that, and I was so happy to be part of the creation of where we are today with how technology has kind of been very supportive of the missions of the Coast Guard. When I think back to 30 years ago, when I last served aboard a Coast Guard cutter, which was a law enforcement 378-foot cutter that patrolled the Bering Sea. Primarily, our job was checking to ensure that the ships in that area were complying within the marine mammal laws, which is that they're catching the right amount of fish or different types of marine resources that they're supposed to do, be there for their safety and so forth. And we would have a helicopter assigned on that ship. Sometimes in bad weather, the helicopter couldn't take off. And remember, we're in the Bering Sea where typically on a normal day, 3 to 5 foot seas was what was often considered as calm. As you've watched the TV shows and then you catch, you can understand what that's all about. But then today, when now with the use of drones, which are unmanned, they're capable of taking almost any kind of weather, as well as the radar equipment that are associated with it, has a far further expanding range that allows us to be able to do searches in different areas, keep track of where the vessels are, where the fishing fleet, if we have to do a rescue of some sort, as well as even from the law enforcement to ensure that any smuggling or whatever, that we can track those vessels much quickly and when needed to do interceptions, that we're able to do it much quicker instead of, and sometimes going back to that 30 years ago when I was on a ship, that it was almost trial and error. So today, technology has really, really gone forward for the Coast Guard. And you also have to look at, with the expanding of technology, things such as cybersecurity. That is even greater in our country today, with particularly in the ports and harbors where vessel traffic systems are set up. That very easy that if someone hacks into the system, it could cause havoc with ships coming in and out of a port, let's say New York, or even a city like Detroit. There, that if someone hacked into that vessel traffic system, cause the ship to run aground, run into each other, and so forth. So the Coast Guard is very much involved with cybersecurity and the maritime domain to protect that.
Well, it's, and again, this is why it's fascinating to talk to somebody with your sort of experience. I really would not have thought about, unless you brought it up, the whole cybersecurity at the port issue and how technology has expanded the role of the Coast Guard. Both the threats that are it's trying to stop and the tools that it would use to stop or thwart such threats. Very interesting. I suspect that the Coast Guard member that you're looking for today has to be adapt to that technology as well. Along the way, you had a stint as a recruiter. Tell us what kind of enlisted folk the recruiters are looking for today in the United States Coast Guard.
Well, clearly, as you said, because of technology, that's very important. Everybody in the Coast Guard, regardless of what their occupational specialty is, they will have their hands on technology at some point or another, be it that they are boat operators or bosun's mate, as we call them, or they're working in admin-type jobs. So everywhere in between, technology is involved. So therefore, we are looking for the young people who are coming in today. First and foremost, they have to be a high school graduate. The Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test, or ASVAB, as it's called, for entry into the Coast Guard, actually higher than any of the other services that require someone to come in. And a very, very extensive training. The first 8 weeks of recruit training in Cape May, New Jersey, which is very, very rigorous. And before you go out into the field, so we're looking for people who know how to be fast learners, the ability to pick up and do certain kinds of things. But even important is the ability to work together, because the Coast Guard is such a small service. Really relies on a lot of people, and it gets to the point where we're relying on people that sometimes the rank becomes pretty even, that the most junior person to the most senior person at different types of units, everybody needs one another to work together. So we're looking for and continue looking for people that, if you want to use the word smart, I would say it's smart from the standpoint that the ability to be a quick thinker and to be innovative, and the ability to work together.
I think it's fair to say that the Coast Guard also led the way both in its officer and enlisted ranks relative to embracing the diversity that this country has, whether it's bringing women into the service or minorities. Can you speak a little bit about the Coast Guard's diversity?
Yeah, you know, I could tell you that, particularly going way back from a historical standpoint, you know, just like with any other part of the of U.S. military, going way back in time, that the military was a segregated service of sorts. All through the years up till after World War II, when President Harry Truman signed Executive Order 99801, which formally integrated the military service. Now, I have to tell you that to tell you that the U.S. Coast Guard had integrated its service long before Harry Truman signed that executive order. We'll date back to at the turn of the 20th century, the late 1890s to the early 20th century, the U.S. Coast Guard had Coast Guard stations located along the, particularly along the Outer Banks of North Carolina and so forth. And they were, at the time, they were pretty much all staffed by an all-black crew. In fact, one particular station, which was very historic in what they did, was the Sea Island Rescue Station, which is located near Cape Hatteras at the time. In the early 40s, the Coast Guard began to integrate those units. And then we had two Coast Guard cutters during World War II that were integrated. U.S. Coast Guard cutter Sea Cloud and U.S. Coast Guard cutter Holcomb were integrated at the time. And then fast-forwarding before that, when women began to have more significant and prominent roles in the military, the Coast Guard was the first military service that had a woman commanding officer in 1979 of a Coast Guard cutter, well before the U.S. Navy did. And the Coast Guard was the first military service where women went to the Coast Guard Academy, Service Academy, the Military Academy started. So we have done an awful lot of firsts, and including even today, the latest change of diversity, particularly with lesbian gay people, that we had already formulated that plan before the U.S. military did away with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So the Coast Guard had always been on the forefront. And why? For probably two ways it happened. One is the fact that Coast Guard has enjoyed the fact of being a military service that served not in the Department of Defense, but going back to the original, it's from 1790 to 1967, under the Department of Treasury, and then from 1967 to 2003 under the Department of Transportation, and now today under the Department of Homeland Security. But however, during a time of war, or when so ordered by the President, the Coast Guard can be transferred to the Defense Department. But as the military service maintains all of the roles, responsibilities, so-called, as a U.S. military service. So the Coast Guard has enjoyed that opportunity of having their feet in two different departments, and has been able to sort of, in some ways, I would say, maybe bend the rules or have the rules to adjust to meet the mission of that service and not have to fully comply with what the Defense Department had going back in time when it was issues such as segregation and so forth that occurred.
Well, let me turn to another question. I'll ask you to put your seasoned hat on here because I, outside of being a recruiter, I suspect you get the chance to do this, and that is, what would you tell a niece, a nephew, a grandkid, a friend's child, hey, what do you think about me joining the Coast Guard?
Well, as recent as yesterday afternoon, I answered that question. And, I use a little bit of my experience in terms of how I ended up in the Coast Guard, not just from walking into the wrong recruiting office. Thank God I did. And I have a great amount of respect and support for every military service, so I never look at it that we're better than the other services, but we're unique in the sense of that if you're interested in wanting to be in an organization that you're both a true individual as well as a collective team member, and the fact that and rank responsibilities come much faster. I mean, really much faster. I think at age 19, you know, with just about 2 years in the Coast Guard at the time, me being placed in a position of responsibility to where I was responsible for directing a search and rescue operation. So I talk a little bit about how quick those responsibilities have happened to me and how it has helped me and helped develop me along the way. And this is what the Coast Guard does, and the fact that you work both, not just as a military service, but you work with the community as well. Let's look at today's situation with some hurricanes, Florence and Michael, and the U.S. Coast Guard down there right now, working to help those individuals that were victims of those disasters and working in the community and so forth. I mean, that's what got me excited.
That's what got you excited, and I suppose you're telling kids these days that it's still a great opportunity for them to join the United States Coast Guard.
Yes, it is. It is a great opportunity, especially today.
We want to thank Master Chief Petty Officer Vince Padden of Detroit for talking to us today on Veterans Radio. And after the news, we'll be back with our second program to learn about U.S. vets and what they're doing around the nation. And welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're glad that you've joined us for this half hour to listen to an interview with the President and CEO of U.S. Vets. It is a veteran assistance program that has been around since, 25 years now. And I think you'll find their approach to dealing with homeless vets and working to prevent homelessness, as well as to work with and help our female veterans, of quite some interest. So sit back and enjoy. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Stephen Peck, who is the President and CEO of U.S. Vets, and we're thrilled to have him on to explain to our national audience all the great work that U.S. Vets has been doing for 25 years. Stephen, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, it's great to have you on. Let's back up and let our audience know a little bit about you. Explain, maybe if you would, your military service and a little bit of your educational background, so we can explain to people how you ended up as President and CEO of U.S. Vets.
I was graduated from college in 1968, which was the height of the Vietnam War, and had gotten a draft notice even before I graduated, and they said, you know, you can complete your college. I got my 2S deferment, but as soon as you graduate, you belong to Uncle Sam. I wanted some choice in that, so I learned about the Marine Corps Platoon Leaders Class program, so that I would, it was inevitable that I was going to go to Vietnam. I was a healthy guy. And so I went through that program, went to boot camp actually before my senior year in college, and then when I graduated, I was commissioned second lieutenant and went to the basic school that every Marine goes through in Quantico, Virginia, and from there went to Fort Sill Artillery School, and went to Vietnam in April of 69.
And you spent your time near Da Nang, as I understand it, and when did you get out of the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I spent my time as a Fort Observer and a fire control officer about 15 miles west of Da Nang, near a place called Charlie Ridge. And I was over there just under a year. In 1970, we actually began to draw down troops from Vietnam. So I came out a little shy of 1 year spent almost another year in the Marine Corps and got out in 1971.
And you transitioned back into civilian life. Everybody back at that period of time, it wasn't an easy transition because it wasn't a very popular to have served and to have been in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But you did pursue a career in filmmaking, which is a sort of a very creative area. Tell us how you got from that career over to U.S. Vets.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't popular to be a Vietnam vet in 1970 and 71. I actually did a year of grad school at USC in the cinema department, and I don't guess more than a couple of people knew that I had been in the Marine Corps. That's just the way it was then. So I struggled some during those years, like many people did, didn't quite know what I wanted to do with myself. Finally, ended up making documentary films. About 1989, so quite some time after I'd gotten back from Vietnam, I got the opportunity to do a film on the combat experience called Heart of the Warrior. And that film played in many film festivals around the country. It was shown at the Harvard School of Government, at Walter Reed Army Hospital, to a room full of psychiatrists, because I really got pretty deep into what the combat experience is like and how it impacts people. And through that experience, I really got involved as an advocate for homeless veterans. I had done a couple of film on the homeless up in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, and really felt drawn by that issue. It is really a failure on our part as a society that there are people living on our streets. And at that point, there were as many as 250,000 homeless veterans in this country. So I at some point, I just didn't want to walk away from that issue. As I said, I had become an advocate. I knew the people over at the West Los Angeles VA here in my hometown. And left filmmaking and began working as an outreach worker at the West Los Angeles VA. I was a guy that went up under the bridges and into the bushes and convinced guys to come into programs.
Sounds like the platoon lieutenant never quite worked its way out of you, did it?
It never did. After I got back from Vietnam, I guess for 8 or 9 years, I never mentioned Vietnam if I could help it. I gave my uniforms away and really avoided that part of my life. I just didn't quite know how to deal with it. But as you said, it's still in there. That sense of camaraderie is still there. That sense of mission is still there. And when I discovered that there were so many veterans who were homeless on the street, I thought maybe that I was in a position to do something about it. As a combat vet, I had some instant cred with guys on the street. They couldn't say, you know, hadn't been there, done that. I found out as soon as I switched careers that I really had a passion for it.
Well, and you went back and got a master's in social work from USC, and I think part of your story, which is so interesting to people, Stephen Peck, president mm-hmm. and CEO of U.S. Vets, is that life often isn't a straight line, and you had to sort of start in one direction, go in another direction until that passion took over. And you became, as I understand it, a full-time director of community development for U.S. Vets back in 1996. So tell mm-hmm. us what the mission has been for U.S. Vets and sort of what the mission is today.
When I was working at the VA in 1993, about 25% of all the veterans who were in the hospital for whatever reason were released to homelessness. So homelessness was a huge problem, and the VA really wasn't doing a whole lot about it. This brand new nonprofit called U.S. Vets started in 1993. And offered housing and services to veterans. Our first budget was really, really small. We had VA social workers working in the building. I was at the VA at that time, and I was the guy who screened veterans coming in. And that really was our learning lab. We learned that homeless veterans don't just need housing. They need a whole range of other services. You know, their tumble into homelessness involved a lot of really traumatic things. They've lost jobs. They've lost families. Maybe there's some mental illness that's unresolved. Maybe there's some substance abuse. So we learned early on that we had to deal with all of that. So we really wanted to become, you know, that kind of one-stop shop, not only providing them the residential stability, but offering them case management and psychological counseling and employment assistance. And that's the basis of our organization as we have grown over the years. From that one site in Los Angeles, we started with 5 vets in there. That site now has 600 veterans living, getting rehabilitative services, and there's some permanent housing there. And we started 10 additional programs. So we're in 11 locations across the country with 20 different residential buildings and 9 different service centers providing the whole range of services. No matter if all they need is a job, if all they need is counseling, if they need housing, we really try to meet them where they are and provide the services that will allow them to become self-sufficient again.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you, Stephen, is that I recognize what a huge endeavor U.S. Vets has undertaken in terms of locations, number of veterans, budget issues, supportive services. Talk to us a little bit about how U.S. Vets has been able to grow and pull this off over 25 years.
We early on were partnered with a developer, and now we partner with a number of different housing developers. They were able to purchase the building that we were first started in. And at that time, the VA was just beginning to address the homeless issue, and they started providing funding for homeless programs. And so we were pretty early on in that movement, and we were very aggressive in going after that VA funding. So we came along at a good time. We had a good idea, that kind of one-stop shop idea where we provide that whole range of services in addition to the housing, and got really good at writing those government grants. And so we were able to then parlay that one site into other sites. Our reputation grew. We were in touch with the national our national lobbying organization, the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans. So people were hearing about what we were doing, and communities would reach out to us and say, we need a program here. And that's how we got to all of our different programs. So I was writing a lot of our grants. So for, 10 or 12 years or so, we could hardly write a grant that we didn't get because we had a good idea. We were a little bit ahead of the curve, and we're able to grow to these 11 sites across the country.
Well, one of the things that I think your U.S. Vets leadership position has allowed it to do is focus on not just the homeless veteran, but also I see many of your supportive services deal with family issues. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we in the beginning, we really focused solely on veterans who were homeless, and generally they had other issues, substance abuse issues, mental health issues. As time has gone on and we've gotten more and more veterans off the streets, we've encountered different populations. So the demographics have changed over time. And so one of the things we're trying to do is grow our homeless prevention programs. Right? If we can get the guys before they become homeless, particularly veterans who have families, it is so much more humane. It is a lot less expensive to do homeless prevention than it is, to do, put them through a residential homeless program. So we participate in a VA program called Support Service for Veteran Families. We have that at many of our locations where we're reaching out, providing rental assistance to veteran families who are in trouble. And the idea is to let's keep them in their housing. You know, as you know, let them not fall into homelessness. Let's keep them in their housing, help them get a job, help them get an income again, do all the things necessary to preserve that family structure, so that they can get back on their feet and move forward again. So I think homeless prevention really is an important part of what we do, both in with families, with mental health, reaching out to community colleges, with a jobs program for veterans who are not homeless, but maybe you know can't find a job, don't know what they want to do. About last year we put about 500 guys back to work through that program at an average wage of about $48,000. So we're reaching beyond the homeless group to the veterans who are at risk of homelessness.
Well, and you're right. It's absolutely sensible and less expensive to prevent those problems, to avoid those problems, than wait until they slip into homelessness with all of the associated challenges that that brings. So it makes tremendous sense to jump in there a little early. And again, that sort of demonstrates some leadership, both by U.S. Vets, but also with the VA. Stephen, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about your view of how VA is doing in this area. We know under President Obama that dealing with the homelessness problem among veterans was a high priority. What kind of report card would you give us today?
I think the progress that the VA made during the Obama presidency was significant. Reduced the homeless population by about 50%. And so add that to the progress we made before that. Since we have started in 93, the homeless veteran population has been reduced by about 80%. So we've made real progress. Thus far, this administration is maintaining that level of funding by and large. So there's been no negative impact. And, you know, it's always our contention that helping veterans is a nonpartisan issue. It just should be. So we've not felt any negative impact. The program hasn't grown at this point. We want to see more homeless prevention. And we've heard that there's going to be some prevention programs. But I think this administration keeps staying on course in terms of providing services for veterans who need help.
U.S. Vets has locations in California, Hawaii, Arizona, Texas, Nevada, and Washington, D.C. I'm wondering whether or not you see a difference in tackling this problem as you move from the West Coast to the East Coast.
We have designed our programs, particularly our kind of intensive rehabilitation programs, on a national basis. The veterans that we're seeing, while the demographics may change, obviously we're seeing more Pacific Islanders in Hawaii, more Native Americans in Arizona. So, there's all these subpopulations, but the issues that got them homeless in the first place are relatively similar. They've maybe grown up in families that really didn't give them any guidance. Maybe they joined the service to get out of where they were. There was not a stable home life. Maybe they picked up a substance abuse problem along the way. I mean, there's a whole range of issues that would impact their ability to take care of themselves after they got out of the Marine Corps. So it's fairly, even though the individual demographics changed a little bit, those major issues are pretty much the same across the country.
I know at the moment that U.S. Vets has a particular focus on trying to look to what our female veterans' needs are in this area. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that, if you will, subpopulation of veterans is now being addressed by not only your organization, U.S. Vets, but sort of the VA in general, maybe, that you interface with?
We've had a women veterans program at our Long Beach site for many years. We were way ahead of the curve there. And for a while, the VA was giving kind of extra points if you designed a women veterans program. You'd kind of get extra points, so you could, so it gave you an advantage to get that funding. They're no longer doing that. I'm not sure why. There is a lot of focus on women veterans. But the VA's program, has not grown, or the VA's ability to fund those programs has not grown. And the result, one result is that if at our Long Beach program, we get women veteran referrals from all over the country, literally. And, you know, as far away as Washington, D.C. and Oregon. So there's an obvious need there. We know that our program is pretty comprehensive. And I think the one thing that separates it from a number of programs is that we offer treatment for military sexual trauma. The amount of sexual harassment and sexual assault that's going on in the military really is unconscionable, and they have not been able to get a handle on that. So that many of the ones that come to us, about 70%, have had sexual trauma of some sort, and so we address that jointly with the Long Beach VA. But still, there's a lot of women veterans who are not accessing services at the VA. And a report came out last year saying that among young women veterans, the suicide rate was 12 times as high as the civilian rate. So we're looking at a very, very significant problem. And of all of those women, only 20% of them were going to the VA. So you have to say, well, they either didn't know that they were eligible for services at the VA, or they didn't want to go there. And the VA has largely been a male bastion. So obviously, if a young woman went into a waiting room and there was 30 guys in there, and they're, you know, someone who had suffered a sexual assault, so they would be very discomforting. So in order to try to reach them, we've started a web portal called Women Vets on Point, which offers a lot of information. There's a questionnaire on there. There's testimonials on there. So without having to speak to anyone, and there's always a lot of stigma around mental health issues. So we want to make it easier for them. They can go there completely anonymously, get a lot of information, and hopefully through all that, it will prompt them to engage with us in the chat room or call us on the phone. Right now, that program is specific to Los Angeles County. Although anyone can access the website, the phone rings in Los Angeles. And our goal then over the next couple of years is to expand that nationwide. And we're now in a partnership with the American Legion Auxiliary, who obviously have units all over the country. They are interested in helping us spread this this service. And we're beginning to design a program with them that will allow their units to reach out into their communities, create networks of mental health providers that can help women in their community. And the goal, obviously, would be to have this available to women veterans in all communities, and expand our ability to outreach to those women who were not seeking treatment when they should be.
Well, I think, again, it's a great demonstration of leadership by U.S. Vets and partnership with the auxiliary, because it makes, you know, they're down in the communities. They've got some relationships that would be impossible to duplicate, just as you have certain relationships and reputation that would be at U.S. Vets that would be impossible to duplicate. We're talking to Stephen Peck, who is the president and CEO of U.S. Vets, which is celebrating its 25th year, serving our veterans with a focus on homeless veterans. Stephen, how can people find out more about the organization? Is there a way that they can stay connected?
Absolutely. We have a website. That's www.usvetsinc.org. That's usvetsinc.org. And you can see on there all the programs that we provide in those 11 locations where we are. And there are other resources on there. If you're not in a state or a city where we're located, there are other resources so that you can reach out into to a provider in your community and help veterans who may be experiencing homelessness or who are in trouble in one way or another. I think we do need these community-based organizations across the country that augment what the VA is doing. So it's really important for the local communities to support those organizations.
And U.S. Vets, like many organizations, needs all kinds of support, financial support. Is there a way for those who might be interested to also provide some financial support to U.S. Vets?
Absolutely. Through our website, there's a donate button. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, so there's a number of ways that you can begin to learn about the services that we provide. We do have a lot of government grants, but we have to raise about 20% of our money every year. And as we grow, obviously that 20% gets bigger and bigger, so we are always welcoming participation by individuals, by corporations and foundations to help us support the programs that we're running.
Well, it's great work that you and your team at U.S. Vets are engaged in. We want to thank you for spending a little time with Veteran Radio today to get the word out about all this great work.
Great. Well, I appreciate the time.
We hope you enjoyed that interview with Stephen Peck of U.S. Vets. They have 20 buildings spread around the country that they're housing vets in. They're continuing to expand their services. They have 500 employees and a $54 million budget. So it's a very solid organization doing great work for our veterans. We want to thank all our veterans today that have provided service to the country on Veterans Day here. A simple thank you is not enough. The country owes you a great debt of gratitude. And if you're listening and haven't said thank you to a vet today, make sure you take a little extra time to do that. We want to thank in particular the management team here at WAAM WAM 1600 Talk Radio in Ann Arbor for their continued support of our storytelling and getting the word out about our veterans. So what WAM does for us can't be measured. We really do appreciate it. We'd hope that you will follow Veterans Radio on Facebook. Send us an email about topics you'd like to hear some more about, and keep in touch with us. We love the story ideas and people that we ought to interview. So it's really important that you keep in contact with us. As I say, you can go to Facebook and look at Veterans Radio, and you'll find it, or go to veteransradio.net and locate us. From veteransradio.net, you can also find our podcasts, which have a lot of extra stories that we get to put up using the internet and making our reach even greater. So if you're looking for a great story midweek, go to veteransradio.net and hit on the podcast and see the weekly stories that we're putting up. So again, happy Veterans Day to everybody. Thank you for your service. And until next time, we will simply wish you a great week. And until next time, you are dismissed.